And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the Race IndyCar podcast, our last one of the year, wondering how long it would take for Alex Palou to win the 2023 IndyCar Championship. He's wrapped it up in Portland a round early. He has 5 wins, 9 podiums, 12 top fives, 16 top tens, and 2 poles on the season. I think we could all agree, a pretty dominant one. Coming up on this week's show, we'll talk a little bit about Alex's progression, a little bit of comparison to 2021 and how much he's changed as a driver. We'll also obviously talk about Dixon being unable to overcome that massive gap and pick out some of the other key performers in the Portland race. We'll also have a lot to talk about with silly season. We'll mention Laguna Seca, obviously, and a very cool test coming up on Wednesday. We'll talk about the leader circle a little bit. We'll touch on Indy next, and then we'll tee up next weekend. So to start with, hello, JR Hildebrand from your almost native San Francisco. How are you doing?
Ah, good. I didn't know you were in SF already. So yeah, that's good to
hear. Yeah, I've arrived. I'm already hearing people say that you're the most famous sporting export out here. So that's cool that people people feel that way.
I don't know who you're talking to. I need to meet
these
people.
The hotel front desk seemed to know who you were. Yeah, so that was pretty cool.
All right, I got a little street cred still.
Yeah. Yeah, I still had my credential on from coming from Portland, and they're like, "Oh, IndyCar, JR Hildebrand's from around here, isn't he?" So hey. I obviously bumped into the only JR Hildebrand fan in San Francisco.
Yeah, I found out where you were staying in advance, and pinned slipped Venmo $20 to the front desk.
Awesome. All right, well, we know we need to talk about Alex Palou, but instead of us talking about him first, JR, why don't we head straight over to a little exclusive interview that was done almost immediately after him wrapping up the championship yesterday. I have to apologize a little bit in advance for some background noise from the track. The USF 2000 and Indy Pro 2000 guys were making a bit of racket in the background, but hopefully you're going to be able to hear all of this and Alex Palou talking many topics. One of them, I guess, I asked him about how it felt to kind of win when he could have been driving for a different team this year and maybe wouldn't have even been in this situation in the first place. We also talked about the great news that he's announced that he's going to be a father in the off season. And yeah, we also talked about obviously his progression as a driver, and he talked a little bit about why he thought this season's been so special for him. So without further ado, we'll head over and chat to Alex Palou. Alex Palou, welcome to the Race IndyCar podcast once again. The last time we had you on was for your pole at the Indy 500, so it's nice to have you on again in more happy circumstances. And we heard before as well that you announced that you are having a baby as well, so big congratulations on that, and for the championship, of course, as well. I guess give us a little taste of how you're feeling, your emotions today. Obviously, you won the championship back in 2021. How different does it feel being sat here today and the kind of emotions that you're feeling after the championship?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, man. It's been a special year, a special day today, clinching my second IndyCar championship. It's better than what I ever thought on my dreams. So feels super, super good, honestly. I just... It feels extra special when you're able to win the race and celebrate. I'd say it would be very different if you just finished 5th or 10th and then you celebrate, but you're not really happy about the race. So yeah, couldn't be happier today.
The way you've won it, obviously winning the race and obviously being able to do that here and wrap up the championship early, I guess does that give it even more satisfaction knowing that you can kind of go into Laguna now and just kind of not relax, but at least everything's done and wrapped up basically after all these questions you've had to face about the championship and all of that happening?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I said, it makes it extra special when you win, but also I started obviously getting a lot of attention about the championship and some people saying that it was about our consistency. And yes, we've been really consistent, but I didn't want to win a championship only by consistency. I wanted to be like, hey, we won five races. Maybe we can even do it again next week, which will be hard. But that's what motivates us a lot, and that's what we wanted to do. I think this is a kind of year that we had the opportunity to do so. We didn't really have that opportunity last year, so we have to take advantage when the times are as good as today.
You mentioned the five wins, and I wanted to ask you what you feel like you've done particularly well yourself this year, and I guess that kind of just what you just said about the not wanting to do it just by consistency. I guess maybe you felt in 2021 that your championship was born out of consistency rather than maybe like doing some of these elite kind of performances that you see from these drivers who are capable of really strong pace. But this year you've delivered five wins, and you've shown even today with the overlap that you had to do, you set like the fastest lap of the race for like five laps in a row there, building that gap and showing that you were the quickest guy in the field. And I guess, does it feel like you've shown that this year, and that's something that's maybe different to 2021?
Yeah, that's very different. As I said, 21, I would say that it was a very championship won by consistency, and this year as well, but it was more like winning races, being super fast on track, having the chances of like, hey, we're fighting for the race, like we're not fighting only for a top five, we're fighting for the race. And there's a big difference on mindset and confidence that gives you. Like today, yeah, we just had a really fast car, and instead of just finishing on the podium, we wanted to win. We did so. So we had the opportunity this year, honestly. The car's been phenomenal. The guy's been phenomenal on the pit stops and strategies as well. So yeah, I just hope that we can continue with the form that we had.
You mentioned the team. I guess there was some uncertainty last year about you could be even racing for another team. Anything could have happened, I guess, coming into this year. And now you've delivered this championship winning year. It's obvious that you're close to a lot of the people in the team, and you feel really kind of, you feel a lot of gratitude toward them for the car that they give you and stuff like that. What does it feel to, I guess, after everything that's happened, to draw a line under everything and kind of deliver the championship for them this year as much as it is for you, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. I think obviously the scenario we're in, and we were also last year, it's not ideal. It's not what I wanted for my career, my image, or for any team. But I wish I did or that things developed differently, but it's not the case. So yeah, I think the least I could do was to get a championship for the team, for myself, for my family, to give everybody back. So yeah, I think we lost the opportunity last year because of things that happened off track, and I couldn't let that happen again.
How will you celebrate? I'm sure there'll be some fried chicken involved, but is there any special plans that you have already that you want to do to kind of celebrate this, or do you already feel like you've got so much with the baby? And I'm sure you'll be testing the 2024 car a bit as well in the second part of this, I guess before Christmas. Do you feel like you're too busy already to think about celebrating?
Yeah, honestly, I haven't thought about it because I was like, man, we need to win it. Dixon is pushing us hard, and you never know what this guy can do. So I don't know, but I'll enjoy every single day, every single moment. I'll go back to Spain and celebrate with the family as soon as the testing, off-season testing, is done. And yeah, I'll just enjoy every single day.
We mentioned some of those people in your team that have been a big part of this success. I know there's way too many to even try and mention all of them and talk about all of them, but the one that I guess has been spoken about a lot this weekend is Barry Wonser, and he's at home obviously having to watch this in a way I'm sure he didn't want. He would have loved to have been at the track to celebrate this success with you, I guess. Can you talk a little bit about what it means to get it over the line for him and to give him the win as well? Because I guess he's been probably one of the most important people in what you've been able to achieve at Ganassi.
Yeah, absolutely. He's been a big, big part, a big director of the 10 car and all the Chip Ganassi Racing team. Yeah, it's sad, but at the same time, I think it's good because they catched it on time and that he's recovering well. We were able to finish the job that he put us in the position to do, so he'll be happy, and hopefully that helps him recover quickly.
Just finally, what are your feelings now, I guess, after wrapping up the second championship? Does it immediately, do your objectives immediately turn to the third championship? Do you think, is there something else that maybe the listeners don't know about that you really want to achieve, you know, moving forward? Or is it that third championship that's the next one for you?
Indy 500, man, that's a big one. We've been close, but it's a tough race. I think it took like more than 10 years to Joseph to win it. It's going to be our fifth one, so we need to keep on working, keep on doing what we've been doing, which we've been really close and really fast, but Indy 500 and the third championship as well, obviously.
We're sat here in Portland, and you've got a lot of commitments and a lot of things to do, so we thank you for joining us, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Thank you.
All right, JR, that's enough of Alex talking about himself. Let's get into this and talk a bit about the race, how he wrapped it up, and talk about him in general. I wanted to start with, I'm going to give you a warning here. I'm going to ask you for a polomant of the year, JR. So while I'm talking, you can have a little think about what you're going to pick. But I kind of wanted to do something a little bit different because everyone's going to talk about how many races he's won and all of these stats that he's racked up this year. We already know how dominant he's been, and we've already kind of explored that on the podcast in great detail over the past, I guess, 7 or 8 months. So I kind of wanted to see if we could pick out some kind of interesting under the radar moments that have really kind of defined this championship. And the first one that came to mind for me was the Indy 500, because I've constantly seen people saying that Alex Palou's had no bad luck this year. And I really disagree with that statement. I think there's been a couple of occasions where he's had some real bad luck, and I think it's more accurate to say that not much has gone wrong for him, because in these moments where things have gone wrong, he's managed to come back from it. And the perfect example was being stuffed in the pit wall by Rinus VK in the Indy 500 when it looked like he might be a contender for victory in that race. And obviously a really bad finish there at the Indy 500 would have been, you know, quite a pivotal moment if we think about the season, because he'd obviously won the Indy GP, but a bad result there at the Indy 500, and then potentially doesn't go on the stunning run that we saw afterwards. And that's what really kind of established that championship lead for the second half of the season. So maybe he would have done it anyway, but I think the Indy 500 was one of those moments people should think back to more when they say he had no bad luck, because he had to come back from that in a really strong way, and he did, and that was one of the reasons I think that kept his kind of momentum rolling from the Indy GP. Obviously we spoke to him as he scored pole for the Indy 500 on the podcast, so you can go back and listen to that and hear about what he was thinking at that point after that Indy GP win and teeing up for the 500. But yeah, that moment in the 500 was a big one for me. Is there anything that stands out for you, JR, a moment where you feel like it was kind of pivotal in the championship, or maybe even just something that really impressed you about Palou that's maybe under the radar compared to just talking about his five wins on the season?
No, I think for me, that run basically from winning the GP, sticking it on the pole at the Speedway in the way that he did, like super trimmed, a very difficult pole run where it seemed like the Arrow McLaren cars or the Chevys generally maybe were the ones to beat there. And so I guess I feel like that was an example of Alex just really, Alex and the 10 team really committing and maybe just doing the best job of anybody in that top six of extracting the maximum pace out of that moment, basically. Winning the pole, having that go wrong, like you said, in the 500, still walking away with the top five. And then for me, actually, rolling all of that into a very weird and potentially very difficult race weekend at Detroit, where he, you know, kind of stamped his authority on just the season at that point. I mean, you've got Indy GP to the 500 to the Speedway to Detroit. It doesn't get much more different in terms of a three race run. To me, that was really the point. After Detroit, he had such a significant margin that was the stage at which usually doesn't happen until like later in the year. I feel like we really saw this weekend. We'll talk about Portland in a minute, but it put everybody else in a mode where they felt like they had to start taking chances basically in the middle of the season to be able to try to close this gap to Alex. And so, you know, this is only partially answering your question, because it's not because there was any really one specific thing that stood out to me. I mean, there's a lot of things that stood out, I guess, over those three weekends, just in the fact that they were all so different. Detroit, I just felt like that was going to be whoever was going to come out on top that weekend was going to be an impressive feat. Basically, whoever was going to win that race was going to have to overcome a lot, was going to have to manage a lot of different types of situations extremely well. You know, restarts, all kinds of different, you know, crazy stuff going on with that long straightaway, a new track, bumpy track, not making mistakes. You know, we saw a lot of that happen with other contenders over that weekend. Alex was just, you know, squeaky clean and just the right level of intensity and aggression from a racing, you know, competitive competition perspective. But I mean, I guess that to me was that run through the basically like approaching the midpoint in the season. It just put everybody else on the back foot. And he was, and we talked about it at the time, that it basically enabled, he had such a wide margin that it enabled him and the 10 team to just continue to stay on the offensive basically for the rest of the year, which they've done. And they did again in Portland. So, I think that Detroit really is the one for me that sort of stands out as, you know, just a really impressive win in a place where you get to see the fact that even though Alex is less flamboyant as a driver, like you just don't, he's not somebody that you're watching his onboard or he's not somebody who the TV directors are cutting to his onboard because there's some crazy shit going on, you know, that you can't miss. But at that type of track, just to see him excel and kind of put it to everybody really struck me as being just evocative of what makes him special, which is this ability to be right on the limit and truly on the edge without you even really noticing. Like there's a level of finesse right at the limit that he has that I feel like, so it to me is really the thing that separates him from everybody else. And I think, and it's the thing that makes me feel like he is the guy that everybody has to beat now, you know, like even Joseph to me up until this point has really seemed like, okay, as long as they just don't have things go wrong, he just seems like the toughest competitor to beat on average over the season. Like he really, we've talked about this before, that he really doesn't have any weaknesses. There's not, he could go out and win at any race. Watching Alex this season, and to me it was just sort of encapsulated in that Detroit performance, was like, well, he's got almost all the things that Joseph has, but then he's got this little other component to his driving style and his way of approaching, you know, his driving the car, different tracks, different situations, that's actually different from Joseph and maybe is a small advantage. So, you know, I think that's something that we really, that I, watching Alex this year, it was, that came to the fore for me more than in his 2021 season. And, yeah, it's just really impressive.
It's definitely an interesting aspect, because if we think back to 2021, I think there was a kind of feeling that Alex had been consistent, and he talked about this in the interview in a kind of negative way. Like he didn't want to just be consistent. He wanted to be he wanted to be unlocking those level of pace that some of those drivers you mentioned are capable of. And I guess in 2021, it was the first time we really got to shine a light on Palou in a top car, kind of seeing how he drove the car. And you're right, everything's so straight and precise and measured that it kind of made you wonder, were some of these other guys like Pato Ward and Colton Herta finding some of that kind of elite pace because they were driving the car in a more aggressive way, and that Alex was never going to be able to kind of match that unless he switched to a similar driving style or was a lot more aggressive with the car. But he's persisted with his style, and I think the first time we saw this was obviously Laguna last year, where he crushed everyone by half a minute. That was probably the first time in a race where we really saw him, you know, properly run away with it. I mean, 2021, he scored some really strong victories, but there was elements to those that were all not about the kind of just the raw pace element, like Barber, where the fuel saving was key and track position and strategy were really important for him. Road America, obviously, Joseph's gearbox, you know, went in the closing stages there. In Portland, he got thrown to the back at the first corner and had to fight his way back on that strategy, but it was always the lead one on that strategy that looked like it was going to be an advantage there to with the fuel. So I guess what I'm saying is, this season he's proven to me that even with that kind of more conservative, let's call it, driving style, I guess. I don't know if that's fair. Conservative probably isn't the right word, but just less flamboyant than some of the other guys that you see. He's still been able to extract this level of crushing performance. And fourth at Indy was the race I mentioned. Detroit was a good one. You mentioned JR, because I think it really showed how his combination of skills have come together, because we know how analytical he is, how he likes to break down a track and approach it. And I always felt going into Detroit with a new track that it was going to be one that he would be able to hit the ground running quite quickly with, because of that ability to kind of break down the sectors of the track and not compromise the rest of the track, the rest of the sectors by improving the car in one area, stuff like that. It's quite good holistic approach to setting a car up over the course of a lap. But then on a street circuit, you also have to deliver that raw pace. And if you can't, then you're not going to win the race. And obviously he managed to do that. And then Toronto is another one, JR, after that run of three races that you mentioned that could have gone horribly wrong with that incident where he almost lost his front wing and ended up finishing second. So that was another race where it felt like, oh, okay, this is going to be an Alex Palou season. It's hard to argue against this going any other way. His oval performance also feels like it's been a step up this year. He was third in Texas, fourth at the Indy 500, as I mentioned, eighth and third at Iowa, and seventh at Gateway. So not maybe the blistering kind of wins that you see out of Joseph Newgarden, but he has a better average finish on ovals than Joseph Newgarden now, I think, at the end of the season. So all impressive stuff from him. And yeah, I think we've covered most of that nicely. The only other thing to mention in the race was another good example of this raw pace that we may be talking about more often now from Alex. And that was when he was on the overcut strategy at the start of the race there. I think a lot of people were wondering how he managed to come out of the pits with I don't know what it was when he immediately came out of the pits. I think it was about 10 seconds on Graham Rahal. And that's because he ripped off about five or six fastest laps of the race while he was out there. And that was what gave him the buffer after a perfect pit stop. So another example there in practice of what we've been talking about a lot, JR, recently, about how it's not just the strategy that's putting Alex Palou in these positions. He's matching it with the level of performance that's needed to make those strategy work. So I guess, was that another thing you noticed from speaking about Portland more specifically, something that you noticed in the race, and maybe the people watching at home who haven't got a timing screen in front of them can't necessarily sort of see that, but it was definitely one of the key aspects of him winning that race.
Yeah, I think that was just a key aspect of just how the race unfolded for a lot of drivers, basically, was... Mm-hmm. You know, and a surprising component of it in that particular exchange. I mean, it was sort of the perfect storm of the drivers that started on the alternate tire pitting earlier than they kind of needed to, in a way, like pitting earlier than, you know, certainly they're not pitting for fuel at that point. So they're coming in mid stint, which is in essence before the black tire was even it proved to be a very, you know, low deg tire just anyway. But you're also the trade-off there, basically, you know, usually what happens in that kind of situation is both tires are degrading at some rate. The guys that were on reds, it wasn't like they were getting just completely mopped up with the guys on blacks at that point. Yes, the drivers that were on blacks were, you know, starting to make some somewhat significant headway. So that transition point had occurred, certainly, but it wasn't like all of those guys that were running up front, McLaughlin, Rahal, whatever, it wasn't like they were all just falling off a cliff. They pitted early enough in the stint, and the black was good enough over the duration of the stint that basically the guys coming out on fresh blacks, because the black was in some sense just a pretty, you know, it stayed relatively, it didn't have like a massive peak at the beginning and it didn't fall off massively at the end, that, you know, in some respects, just the fact that those cars are now on a full load of fuel, whereas you've got Palou and Dixon in A, really good cars, B, both of those guys we know are really good at this track, but then C, they're not experiencing significant deg yet from the tire, and they're on not insignificantly less fuel, basically, than the cars that are now full of fuel and coming out in traffic. You know, we saw that was, you know, an aspect of this whole thing, because you've got mixed up strategies that, you know, that basically just ended up playing into the hands of Palou and Dixon, that they were able to just rip a bunch of laps and that didn't seem like that was, as you just sort of alluded to, like that wasn't necessarily qualifying lap performance. That's just what was available in the car on the black tire at that stage in the race. And so, you know, that was definitely, I felt like watching it, I had to kind of, you know, you're almost sitting there like, what am I missing here? Like, did all of those guys that just pitted all have bad pit stops, or did they all come out and just get totally hosed on their outlaps in traffic, or, you know, something like that? But then, you know, you recognize that didn't really happen, or it certainly didn't happen for all of them. And that, you know, basically the pace was just there for the guys that were on blocks. And that essentially ended up, as we saw watching the race, that sort of dictated in essence the rundown for the whole rest of the race, because as the track then rubbered in and those cars had to go to reds at some point later on, they didn't experience the same degradation that the cars that pitted at the beginning were. And so it in essence jumbled the order after everybody's first stint, and that didn't change that dramatically for the rest of the race.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
All right, Jael, let's crack on with the race. Scott Dixon, I didn't really feel like he had a massive chance to keep things alive unless something really bad happened to Alex Palou, and obviously nothing bad happened to Alex Palou. He won the race, so it was always going to be difficult, especially with the point system the way it is, with Alex basically scoring 5 points just by starting in Laguna Seca, so cutting that 72 point gap down to what effectively needed to be 48 to have a serious chance, if we're calling that a serious chance, was always going to be difficult. He felt like he had a chance if something went wrong, but it was never really going to be something that he could kind of put this on his back and push this forward on his own. I guess the most interesting aspect of the whole Dixon thing, because he kind of mirrored Alex's strategy, apart from that he went for the softs in the third stint instead of the second stint like Alex did. It was a pretty straightforward, like, trying to do something similar to Alex but different at the same time to try and give himself that edge. But I didn't really feel like there was anything major that played out there. What kind of did stand out to me was the amount of F words he said on his radio as he got, I guess, kind of felt like at least he got robbed of the chance of second there because of IndyCar's new system of leaving the pits open to let people pit when there's clearly a car that's going to bring out caution. Aside from the safety element that Scott raised, which I thought was a valid one, it was quite a dangerous place to leave a car for so long. He was mad because Felix didn't do an outlap, which meant he didn't lose as much time as Scott would have done in his previous pit stop. So he was basically saying that even though IndyCar is trying to help by, you know, letting Felix pit, somebody else has kind of been, you know, let go there. And also a kind of additional but similar kind of, I guess, rule-related thing. We had Pato O'Ward being quite irate after the race as well about being held up by traffic. So we had kind of two little things going on there here in the kind of aftermath of the race in terms of questioning why things are happening and looking a little bit at that. So I guess with Dixon, do you kind of agree with him that this... I guess my feeling is that in most races, this does help people, you know, not get hosed by a caution. But it just so happened in this case, when you've got one car like that and he's fighting for a significant position, you've basically got you know, Felix getting a massive advantage by not having to do the outlap. So I don't know if I felt like this was more like a isolated incident, or whether JR, you've got maybe a different opinion or can explain it a bit better than I can.
Well, this has definitely happened more than once. You know, so I guess I would say I do think that this needs to be reviewed. I feel like the sort of spirit of the way that they do this, I think, is probably in the right place, which is, you know, the other way of doing it basically is Felix gets totally screwed, basically, by being on a strategy that they're trying to go long in that part of the race. And so, you know, he ends up, if they call for full course yellow and the pits are closed at that point, then Felix has to stay out. He's basically going to end up cycling all the way to the back, because wherever he, you know, he's going to be in essence in the effective lead of the race, but then have to pit once everybody's bunched together. So he's going to be the last car in the lead lap, basically, by the time that he pits. So it's a little bit rare that it's sort of infrequent that, and I actually should say that I don't know that he was, there must have been other cars that were, you know, that also had to, that were on like similar strategy to Felix. We're talking about him as kind of the one that, you know, was most in play here at the end of the race. And so, you know, they do this to basically try to avoid that, which is sending cars that are competing for podiums, for top fives, maybe for the win, whatever, for just sending them immediately to the back of the cars and lead lap. You can imagine, if, you know, given that this was at the end of the race, there's basically no way that Felix comes back from that. Besides just, you know, maybe he ends up on slightly fresher tires in the cars that he's around, but we kind of know that that doesn't usually play, you know, a significant enough factor in kind of how those races are going. Cause this typically is happening in a pit sequence anyway. So everybody's on relatively, you know, fresh rubber one way or the other. But Dixon, you know, I think there's two legitimate gripes here from Dixon's point of view. One is this is then giving those cars that are in Felix's position, it's giving them an advantage instead of, like, really the way that this should work is that they should be, you know, the chance that you're kind of leaving it up to chance in any of these kinds of situations by playing a strategy that you're going to pit late. That's just part of you factor that in. Everybody's factoring that in potentially to what the risks and odds of having it go right, having it fall your way or not. So you're sort of giving him a free pass, and then he ends up actually gaining an advantage by you giving him the free pass. So you kind of get this double advantage in this situation compared to how it should be in some respects, or how it would normally be. I totally agree with Scott that car in particular was in quite a dangerous spot to just have no yellow whatsoever. So that seems, that part of it was absurd to me. I think there is a middle ground here, which is you just immediately go full course yellow and just leave the pits open for a lap, maybe. You know, I mean, that you probably end up with the pack bunching up some. So maybe you cut into the advantage that, you know, that the cars that are still out that are, you're going to leave the pits open so that, you know, Felix in this situation, maybe that enables Scott to, like, close the gap up to Felix enough that kind of he doesn't, for by no fault of his own, end up, you know, losing a bunch of track position because this works out the way that it does. But, you know, I think that this at bare minimum needs a little riff on it to kind of consider how this has happened. I mean, I can certainly remember, I think last year at Mid-Ohio, this happened, and Newgarden. And the only reason I know that I remember this as clearly as I did, just because I was really confused about how it ended up working out during the race that year, that Joseph was running fourth or fifth or something, and then suddenly was like eighth after that caution had played out, in essence, a caution that was just like this, pits left open to allow, you know, I believe, like, McLaughlin and some of the guys that were, you know, in the lead of the race at that point had stayed out. So it's sort of, you know, this rule exists, or this way of addressing these situations exists to try to have cautions play less of a, you know, sort of a spoiler in the race. But, you know, like Scott was kind of detailing, that there comes some complexities in that that end up screwing guys anyway. And so I think that it needs to be looked at from that perspective, because I think probably if you address the fact that it's there is an element of it that is unsafe, then maybe you also more often than not, or you at least eat into addressing kind of the other component of this, which is not to love. The other thing that I was surprised by was the fact that they left cars that were a lap down where they were at that last yellow, which I guess is because they only move cars to the back if it's inside the last like 20 laps or something. But that this and that, you know, that caution was on, maybe they went back green with like 22 to go or something. So maybe that's why that didn't happen. But that also totally screwed Scott. Like, you basically had Pillow and Rosenquist and then like three lapped cars and then Dixon. So that just in terms of, you know, again, if we're, it's like, and this goes into Pato's gripe, which is just about lapped cars in general, particularly at the end of the race, which we've talked about a number of times and just seems like it continues to be brought up, is like, all right, I personally just think we need to be a little bit more, we need to like at least be, whether this is how we decide what the rule is going to be or whatever, we need to be aware of the fact that, especially in a situation like this, and this is what Pato was talking about, everybody's made their final pit stop. You are not going to get your lap back at this point. So, like, why isn't the rule, in essence, just that once that has happened, at whatever point that's happened in the race, then all of these, you know, then we kind of go into this late race mode where all, you know, lap cars are all going to the back of the field. Everybody's getting command blue flag. You know, you're taken away, push to pass. You're doing all of these things. Like, I think a lot of the drivers would say that should happen much earlier in the race, and that there are races where it starts to play a factor much earlier in the race. But at a bare minimum, I think that IndyCar should take into some real consideration revising the sort of timing of when some of these lapped car, like, you know, the criteria for when we start treating lapped cars differently, like how and why that comes into play. Because I do think that to me, even more so than Felix kind of getting a leg up in this whole situation, sort of made the end of this race totally anticlimactic between Pillow and Dixon. I mean, even if you had left Rosenquist in there in second, there would have been at least a couple of laps there where you thought, all right, if Dixon can get by, or maybe Rosenquist pushes Pillow and Pillow makes a little mistake because they're on different tires, Rosenquist is on the red, maybe Rosenquist gets by, you know, whatever. Like, there would have at least been, as a viewer, there would have been a thought in your mind about the potential for there to be something interesting going on here. And instead, a little bit to Pato's point, I feel like somehow we're still kind of prioritizing, you know, lapped cars being able to race. And it's just like, well, like, ultimately that's making it, in more often than not, that's making it so that the cars that are on the lead lap that are actually fighting for wins and podiums and top fives and whatever, that at that point, it's not to say you care about those drivers more, but in that situation, they matter a lot more in terms of what's going on in the race. I just think it definitely needs a good look at to figure out how we can improve improve the experience for the drivers and for the fans in terms of what they really want to see from the end of these events. So that's I guess that's my two cents on on all of those gripes.
Yeah, I think the safety aspect of this one really worried me, to be honest. There's been so many occasions where they've left the pits open when a car's been like parked up well off the track and has been, you know, has looked pretty safe and in a place where the driver can get out, or that they're just well out of contention. But where Canapino was stopped was where we saw, you know, at least two or three drivers in practice go off. Newgarden being probably the most memorable, because he ended up in the wall at the exit there. But we saw drivers kicking up the dust there quite often and getting wide, and it only took, you know, only would have taken a mistake there for something bad to happen there. So I hope they'll look at that. I'd say it's one of the if I was looking at IndyCar safety in terms of just how a race operates, it would be like one of the top priorities for me is looking at that and making sure that good decisions being made, along with, I think we see too many races where we have moving safety vehicles and people on track when cars are still moving, because that, just from experience, that's just something that always makes me nervous and I always like to see less of. So I think those would be my two kind of safety concerns. And I guess just to address on O'Ward, you're right, because one of the reasons he was so annoyed, I think, was because they hadn't reordered the cars at the end there and it held him up. It wasn't just general lap traffic through the race. I think it was that specific moment that really got him riled up. I think we're just seeing like a really high standard, right? Like, maybe this wouldn't have been a problem 10 or 15 years ago when we're seeing a lower standard of driver and team even compared to the top guys in the series. I think the standards raised so high that it's just difficult to pass lap traffic, and especially on what is one of the shortest road courses on the calendar. It's not an easy place to overtake necessarily, apart from turn one, and even turn one can be a difficult place to overtake later in a stint, as opposed to just the start of the race where it's always talked about as a big option. So yeah, I think not to disagree with anything you've put out there, JL. Just a quick one, give us your two cents on the Palou kind of blocking situation. Did you think he'd moved there and that was a penalty, or were you kind of happy with how that was called?
It's definitely on the...
It was on the edge, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely on the edge. I mean, I felt like on the broadcast, they ended up kind of focusing in on the fact that he moved back over to the left. That part of it doesn't really bother me, just because that's basically just like driving back over. That's driving back to the racing line. So I don't really care. It wasn't like Elio was trying to set up to pass him on the outside there and he blocked him. He was just moving back over. No. The first move was the one that was really questionable, the move to the right. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. It wasn't something like, if they hadn't made a big deal out of it, I'm not sure I would have cared. So in the big scheme of things, it doesn't really...
Yeah.
It's something that you could point to and say this or that about, you know, the officiating being a little, I don't know. That's just one of those things that I don't think it actually really made. It was not a pivotal thing in the race as far as I was concerned. You know, if he had done that to a car that was for position, then I might have thought about it differently. Like, I might have thought, oh, that was that one time that Dixon was going to be able to get by him or something. But it was ultimately just like a very momentary, hey, like, don't screw me over here, Elio, or whoever it was. I think it was Elio, right?
Yeah, it was Elio.
You know, that, I guess because of that, I just don't, it was kind of neither here nor there as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, I think the thing that kind of made me okay with it was that if you're a driver defending a position, not blocking, but just trying to position your car in a defensive way, then you would come off that corner and then immediately kind of move to the center of the track, which is what he did, and then didn't move back over until he was at the kind of point of entry for the corner where he was taking the racing line. So for me, that all felt above board and I wasn't bothered about that. It was always going to be a social media hot topic with Alex fighting for the championship and people interpreting that in either way, but I thought it was okay.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner StubHub has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Just quickly before we get on to some other bits, Joe, I just wanted to round up some other drivers. So Felix Rosenquist scored his best result of the year in second. So he felt important to mention, as did Rinus VK, who was, I guess, second on the strategy of the guys who... No, he was first of the strategy of the guys who started on the on the soft tyres.
Yeah.
Joseph actually started on the hard, didn't he? So that was super impressive from Rinus. I mean, I think he definitely dumped Marcus Ericsson off the track at one point, which was, I thought was harsh. I didn't leave him any room and just literally just ran him off the road and finished one position ahead of him in the race, which was quite significant, I felt like. But still, Rinus has been on a much improved run recently with that team. I guess it's roughly since RHR came in. I don't know how significant that specifically is to Rinus's performances, but he's definitely been on a strong run recently. David Malukas also came from... He came from 23rd he started? Yeah, it was 23rd to 8th. Pitted on that first caution there and went long, so did well. And finished ahead of Scotty Mack, who in turn finished three places ahead of Graham Rahal, who was on pole. So a really tough race for Graham and those guys who started on the softs. I think the traffic element really hurt them in the second or the third stint. And Graham at one point was... totally dumped offline at turn one, wasn't he, defending from some guys or trying to get past some guys who'd just come out of the pits that held him up really significantly and dropped him back a few places, even behind Christian Lundgaard, who'd started 17th as well. So that was a bit of a painful one. There's a couple other drivers to mention. Yuri Vips made his debut for Rahal Letterman-Lanigan as well. Started 18th, finished 18th, pretty sensible race. Didn't do anything too wrong there. I think they were quite conservative with the strategy and just trying to keep him learning, keep him out on track, giving him some different experiences to kind of adapt to in the race. So we'll keep an eye on him at Laguna and see how much he's learned. And Tom Blomqvist was 24th in the end. It was a difficult weekend for Tom, I thought. He was like 6 tenths off Helio in qualifying, which was a bit disappointing, really, to be honest. But I'm sure he's fighting a lot of things there with his second IndyCar start, and obviously he's not done Portland before. So I think we'll judge Tom a little bit more, not judge in the negative way, but just kind of interpret how he's getting on after Laguna, where he's raced a few times in IMSA, so he should have a better grasp of the track there.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was thinking the same thing with Blomqvist. Just like, I think after having Linus in the car and being quite, you know, in a relative sense, quite competitive at a lot of these places but also, you know, you have to kind of take a step back and realize like, okay, well, Linus has been at these places that he's racing in the Indy car, in the Indy Lights car, or in the Indy Next car. He's, you know, he's familiar with the tracks. He's probably in some respects just as familiar with the car. You know, I think that there, you could probably make an argument that there's more carryover in terms of, you know, what you're kind of bringing from the Indy Next car, the Indy Lights car to the Indy car than there is even from a top level sports car. There's just, you know, you're coming from a car that's got traction control, and you know, there's just more differences the way that they feel, the way that they, you know, you kind of, they're on much different tires. You know, the Michelin that the prototypes run is definitely different than the Firestone that we run on in the IndyCar series. So yeah, a lot of things for him to be getting used to, but I'm definitely, you know, kind of anxiously waiting for Tom to break out a little bit here at one of these events. So I agree with you that Laguna will definitely be an interesting one from that point of view. They've obviously already committed to next year. You've seen, you know, you appreciate that Shank has seen a lot more from Tom than maybe we have just from running him in the sports car stuff. So, you know, we'll look for that to, sort of come to fruition, you know, potentially as early as this upcoming weekend. I thought Yuri Vips did an awesome job. I mean, basically he was on pace right away in first practice. So that to me was Linus Lundqvist-esque in terms of, you know, the first time that we see him in the car. And, you know, you can make the argument that Yuri's got, you know, frankly, much less experience, much less relevant experience, just in terms of the track, the car, any of these types of things. So, it'll definitely be, I imagine that he made himself quite a positive impression within that team from an on-track performance point of view this past weekend heading in. So I guess maybe, with that in mind, what can you tell us about silly season? We thought they were getting crazy like a couple of months ago. It seems like they're just going completely off the rails by now.
Yeah, I feel like anything I tell you now is going to change within the next 3 minutes and then change again in the next 10. So hopefully this podcast isn't out of date by the time you actually listen to it. I think we were relatively sure that David Malukas was going to be heading to Andretti, but we've had a significant turnaround there because it looks like Arrow McLaren have stolen in and will put him in the car that they thought Alex Palou was going to drive. But obviously, Zak Brown revealed recently that Alex Palou is not going to come to McLaren. And we had, in the aftermath of the championship win, we had Chip Ganassi say that Alex Palou will be back in his car next season. Paraphrasing slightly, but you can go back and listen to that in the post-race broadcast there. So we have some Alex Palou movement. We have some David Malukas movement, which is a very interesting one. I think there's a lot of McLaren could have done a lot of different things with that seat, including taking other drivers from the series. They could have brought in some guys that they're familiar with from Europe, but have gone with this, I guess, the second youngest driver in the series who has shown some flashes of pace, but maybe struggled a little bit. We talked about on previous podcasts to establish himself with Coyne basically being pillaged of most of its staff for the past few years, going to bigger teams. So it's been a difficult one for him to show what he's capable of, but McLaren have decided that he's worthy of that seat. And you can go back and listen to an interview with David from a couple of episodes ago, where we spoke to him just before Gateway, where he was on the podium again. So that was impressive. The other kind of, I don't know if movement's the right word, because this is what we've heard this one for a little while, but with Felix Rosenqvist, we expected that the news that Alex Palou wouldn't be joining McLaren could maybe open up the chance for Felix to stay for another season, which is what happened to him last season. He was in limbo over whether Alex Palou was going to join the team. Ended up that he didn't, and then got his reprieve. He didn't want to go to Formula E and ended up staying. But this time he's decided that he's going to join Meyer Shank. So he'll be announced at some point in the very near future as Tom Blomqvist's teammate, which is an interesting one because it means, well, it likely, we haven't had any sort of confirmation yet, so I guess we'll know a little bit more with the announcement. But Simon Pagenaud is unlikely to have a full-time IndyCar seat next season as things stand. Obviously, he's got the concussion that he had from the somersault in mid-Ohio crash. So we obviously wish him again, as we've spoken about recently, spoke about last week on the pod. We wish him the best with his recovery and everything that's going on there. We don't know if he's going to return next season, if he'll be able to, but we hope he can. We hope he his recovery continues to go well and that he lands with a 2016 IndyCar champion, 2019 Indy 500 winner, someone who had a really bad start to the season and was probably already, you know, Shank were already looking at his position before the concussion, as to whether they were going to bring him back. He's out of contract at the end of the season. So that start to the year has really hurt Simon. So that's a difficult one to see how that plays out. But we hope Simon lands on his feet somewhere for next season. I guess the other significant changes to make are Romain Grosjean looks set to be leaving Andretti, something that's probably been well known for a while and something we've probably, I think, even spoken about on the pod at some point in the last few weeks. He's in talks with multiple teams. Dale Coyne's an option to go back to from where he started his IndyCar career. Definitely know he's in conversation with a couple of other teams as well. So I'm sure those talks will continue through this week and into Laguna and out of it. Andretti is an interesting one because without Malukas coming in, that potentially gave them an open fourth seat to keep Roman, but it looks like Roman's still going to leave. And there's a very real possibility that Andretti could drop to three cars for next season, which I think would be a brilliant move. I think Penske have shown how beneficial that can be in recent years. And of all the teams to do it, I think Andretti just slimming down a car and just, I guess, getting all of the right pit people in place for the three cars that they do have, making use of those additional engineers, keeping them on and doing some development work and trying to get to the bottom of some of their problems and just execute properly on race weekends. I feel like going to three cars would be a great move for them, but they've not totally ruled out staying at four with a different driver. So I guess we'll definitely keep an eye on that. Marcus Armstrong's also set to join Alex Palou at Ganassi for next season with Scott Dixon and Linus Lundqvist, who've already been, well, Linus Lundqvist's already been confirmed there. And Dixon just kind of turns up at the start of the next season each year without having any kind of fanfare over his contracts. That's all definitely kept quiet usually. I think that's all that we can mention so far at the moment, JR. Obviously, Laguna coming up will be a little bit of movement. I guess by the time you listen to this pod, some of those drivers I've mentioned might already be publicly announced by those teams. And no doubt by the time we get to Laguna, all 27 full-time seats will have changed and that different drivers will be in every single car. And that's kind of how this silly season feels like it's played out.
I think that's just what we should do for the last race. If I think that should be the deal.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
If the championship has already been decided before the last race, then all of the championship positions get locked in and everybody has to do a seat swap for the last event. I would love to see that.
That would be absolutely fantastic.
Make it happen, Roger.
Yeah. Speaking of fantastic ideas, JR, speaking of fantastic ideas, we mentioned on last week's pod that Brian Herter should drive his 98 winning Laguna Seca car at Laguna Seca, and guess what, he is. I can't pretend to have foreseen that because I had no prior knowledge of this happening, but yeah, he's gonna drive on Wednesday, so keep an eye on your social media on Wednesday, because the plan at the moment is for Brian and Colton to drive the car. I'm told it's got near 1,000 brake, and Cosworth have been working hard on the engine to bring it up to speed. Also, I think Firestone have donated, I hope they've donated multiple sets of tyres, but I'm sure they've donated it. Well, they have donated at least one set of tyres. And on a resurfaced Laguna Seca, that's going to be quite something to watch, I think. And probably JR's going to get very excited and use it as some sort of proof that IndyCar needs to be at 1,000 brake and that we basically need to go back to 1998. Have I got that right?
Well, I definitely want to make clear that my position is not that I think that we should go back to 1998, but I certainly think that there are a lot of elements of the cars the way they used to be that we should just be factoring into the way that we think about the car going forward. We've obviously made a lot of progress in terms of, you know, what the car is and why it is what it is, but I think there's also been a lot of change that hasn't necessarily made it better for either drivers or the fans, which I think is ultimately those are the two most important customers of our sport. So I do feel like, if nothing else, I think we should take a little credit for like speaking this into existence or something. I'm sure it was already planned.
It's been a long time in the planning, this one, I think.
Yeah,
based on how much work's had to go in.
But anyway, yeah, no, I'm definitely excited for that, and interesting. You know, I mean, interesting. Just to touch on some of the silly season comments, like, you know, I think it just goes to show. Well, one, I think it does a little bit of all of this speaks to, you know, there are some things that have yet to become like really stable in terms of, you know, the way that IndyCar kind of it's long-term. Obviously IndyCar has to renegotiate a TV contract. I think they are quite optimistic about how that's going to work. And, you know, that creates for rev share with the teams and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we've seen viewership go up this year. We've seen IndyCar become much more committed to their social channels and video viewership. And we've seen, you know, you've seen the result of that be, you know, definite, you know, and in some cases, somewhat substantial increase in you know, engagement, which, you know, I guess I kind of sit there and go, all right, well, is that just sort of catching up to where we should be, or is that, you know, is that moving the needle really significantly? The manufacturer situation for IndyCar going forward is definitely still a pretty significant hurdle, but, you know, I think that just in terms of the way the teams are operating, the fact that you've got so much silly season movement is in part a reflection of the teams having the dollars to go out and try to get the guys that they want to get, you know? And so I think it's really great to see, you know, Felix and Roman, even after the year that he's had, you know, to still be in the mix for, you know, we know that these are guys that are not bringing a check. So, you know, definitely will be interesting to see how they play, that plays out. You know, like you said about Simon, you know, we obviously just don't really know where he's at going into next year. So, you know, I think we kind of reserve a little bit of judgment on, you know, I think there's kind of, you'd like to say in sports that you don't lose your job, you know, by getting hurt, but that, you know, we also know that that's just not how it works. And, you know, I think until we learn a little bit more about Simon's situation going forward, what he, you know, wants to do, how he feels about some of these things, you know, it's hard to comment on them any more than that. So we'll just kind of see how that all shakes out. But I sort of agree with you at Andretti, because it does seem like it sounds as though, at least to me, that they're spooling up to become more involved with the Wayne Taylor Acura program as well. So you'd sort of think, just in an effort, they've expanded a lot. They've gotten their hands in a lot of different things over the last couple of years, and they've got this F1 bid that's still in process, and a new factory, and, you know, whatever, new race shop, like all of this kind of stuff. You know, it seems like potentially downsizing the IndyCar program, you know, that could be a good thing for them, and just focus on, you know, focus on three guys that they know are you know, at the top of the, you know, our elite drivers within the sport. I mean, that definitely, like you said about Penske, there's at least one good case study out there of that being a positive thing in terms of the way the organization works and being able to get, you know, get back to that level of performance that we've seen from them this year, but just not as consistently as it needs to be.
All right. I think the only other thing to mention that's linked to silly season is to keep an eye on the teams as well and how I guess the off-season plays out in terms of technical tie-ups, because we've already had Marshall Pruitt report that AJ Foyt and Penske are linking up for a little bit of kind of a joint venture for the future. So we'll keep an eye on that one. And there's rumors for other ones as well. I guess the 2+2 one is Aaron McLaren and Hunkos, two Chevrolet teams who could potentially tie up in some way, shape or form for next season. Not confirmed at the moment, but just something that's been talked about in the paddock by people who kind of know what's going on. So we'll keep an eye and see if that kind of, you know, comes to fruition at all. The other kind of linked element is the leader circle, we should mention. That's the contract that the IndyCar has with the teams, but the key part of that for fans watching is that the top 22 cars in the owner's point standings will receive just over $900,000 at the end of the season. So obviously a big dogfight going on down there for that. We've not mentioned it too much recently because it's just so open at the minute. There's so many cars who are mathematically in contention to either be in or out there. We're looking at the 28 Carpenter Racing car, Ryan Hunter-Reay. I think both of my Shank cars are kind of in the window. So we'll keep an eye on those as well. We've also got Agustin Canapino, Yuri Vips, Devlin DeFrancesco. I think at this point, Stingray Rob and Dale Coyne are probably out. But I think still mathematically, with a chance going in. So we'll keep an eye on that. That'll be a really tight battle. And without a championship win to look for in the final round for the first time for a very, very, very long time, we'll be keeping an eye on how all that plays out. And I also wanted to mention just before we sign off that Louis Foster won the Indy next race at Portland with a pretty dominant performance from pole. More significantly, there was drama for the title rivals. Hunter McElroy had his race ruined by a turn one incident. Christian Rasmussen also got spun round, but actually managed to stay out of any kind of serious trouble and was able to get back and be in contention in the race. So that was extremely positive for Christian. And the last race of the year at Laguna is a double header for those guys. So we'll keep an eye on that. We know that Christian finished fifth, and that means that he has 445 points compared to Hunter McElroy's 380. So a nice lead going in, but there is two races, so lots of points on offer there. Just mentioning Laguna quickly, we've talked about the resurfacing quite a bit on the previous pod, but keep an eye on that and how it impacts things. Obviously, we had Alex Palou crush everyone there last year, but with a resurfaced track, it'll be interesting to see if that changes. We've also got a full series test on Thursday, so you'd like to think that there's at least an even playing field in terms of people getting prepared and being ready to go there. So we'll definitely keep an eye on that. JR, thanks for joining me this week. Really appreciate it. It's been great to get your insight on some really interesting issues that I know you will have enjoyed getting into. And it was good to talk about the silly season a little bit, as things will definitely start to unfold as you're listening to this podcast already. And yeah, a big final congratulations to Alex Palou on winning the 2023 IndyCar Championship. Well deserved. Hope you enjoyed the interview with him. And definitely go back and check out our recent podcasts where you can find some interviews with some cool drivers like David Malukas, as I mentioned. You can learn a little bit more about his season, where things have gone right and wrong for him. So that's all for this episode of the Race IndyCar Podcast. We'll be back after Laguna Seca.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic.
See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.